Socialist Party, was Blomberg's later comment. Among the officers, the reaction to the oath was mixed. Some were sceptical or dubious. "The darkest day of my life," Beck was reported to have remarked. "A momentous oath. Pray God that both sides hold to it with the same loyalty for the good of Germany," wrote Guderian. But the majority spent little time reflecting on its implications. The oath meant that the distinction between loyalty to the state and loyalty to Hitler had been eradicated. Opposition was made more difficult. For those later hesitant about joining the conspiracy against Hitler, the oath would also provide an excuse. Far from creating a dependence of Hitler on the army, the oath, stemming from ill-conceived ambitions of the Reichswehr leadership, marked the symbolic moment where the army chained itself to the Führer. "Today, Hitler is the whole of Germany," ran a headline on the 4th of August. The funeral of the Reich president, held with great pomp and circumstance at the Tannenberg Memorial in East Prussia, the scene of his great victory in the First World War, saw Hindenburg, who had represented the only countervailing source of loyalty, enter Valhalla, as Hitler put it. Hindenburg had wanted to be buried at Neudeck. Ever alert to propaganda opportunities, Hitler insisted on his burial in the Tannenberg Memorial. On the 19th of August, the silent coup of the first days of the month duly gained its ritual plebiscitary confirmation. According to the official figures, 89.9% of the voters supported Hitler's constitutionally now unlimited powers as head of state, head of government, leader of the party, and supreme commander of the armed forces. The result, disappointing though it was to the Nazi leadership, and less impressive as a show of support than might perhaps have been imagined when all account is taken of the obvious pressures and manipulation, nevertheless reflected the fact that Hitler had the backing, much of it fervently enthusiastic, of the great majority of the German people. In the few weeks embracing the Röhm affair and the death of Hindenburg, Hitler had removed all remaining threats to his position with an ease which even in the spring and early summer of 1934 could have been barely imagined. He was now institutionally unchallengeable, backed by the big battalions, adored by much of the population. He had secured total power. The Führer state was established. Germany had bound itself to the dictatorship it had created. After the crisis-ridden summer, Hitler was, by September, once again in his element on the huge propaganda stage of the Nuremberg rally. In contrast even to the previous year's rally, this was consciously devised as a vehicle of the Führer cult. Hitler now towered above his movement, which had assembled to pay him homage. The film, which the talented and glamorous director Leni Riefenstahl made of the rally, subsequently played to packed houses throughout Germany and made its own significant contribution to the glorification of Hitler. The title of the film, devised by Hitler himself, was Triumph of the Will. In reality, his triumph owed only a little to will. It owed far more to those who, in the power struggles of the summer, had much to gain, or thought they had, by placing the German state at Hitler's disposal. 13. Working towards the Führer. It is the duty of every single person to attempt, in the spirit of the Führer, to work towards him. Werner Willikens, 21st of February 1934. The Führer had for outward appearances to ban individual actions against the Jews in consideration of foreign policy, but in reality was wholly in agreement that each individual should continue on his own initiative the fight against Jewry in the most rigorous and radical form. Reported opinion in Hessen, March 1936. I go with the certainty of a sleepwalker along the path laid out for me by Providence. Hitler, the 14th of March, 1936. Everyone with opportunity to observe it knows that the Führer can only with great difficulty order from above everything that he intends to carry out sooner or later. On the contrary, until now, everyone has best worked in his place in the new Germany if, so to speak, he works towards the Führer. This was the central idea of a speech made by Werner Willikens, State Secretary in the Prussian Agriculture Ministry, at a meeting of representatives from Länder Agriculture Ministries held in Berlin on the 21st of February 1934. Willikens continued, "Very often, and in many places, it has been the case that individuals, already in previous years, have waited for commands and orders. Unfortunately, that will probably also be so in the future. Rather, however, it is the duty of every single person to attempt, in the spirit of the Führer, to work towards him. Anyone making mistakes will come to notice it soon enough, but the one who works correctly towards the Führer, along his lines and towards his aim, will in future, as previously, have the finest reward of one day suddenly attaining the legal confirmation of his work. These comments, made in a routine speech, hold a key to how the Third Reich operated. Between Hindenburg's death at the beginning of August 1934 and the Blomberg-Fritsch crisis in late January and early February 1938, the Führer state took shape. These were the normal years of the Third Reich that lived in the memories of many contemporaries as the good years, though they were scarcely that for the already growing numbers of victims of Nazism. But they were also years in which the cumulative radicalization, so characteristic of the Nazi regime, began to gather pace. One feature of this process was the fragmentation of government as Hitler's form of personalized rule distorted the machinery of administration and called into being a panoply of overlapping and competing agencies dependent in differing ways upon the will of the Führer. At the same time, the racial and expansionist goals at the heart of Hitler's own Weltanschauung began in these years gradually to come more sharply into focus, though by no means always as a direct consequence of Hitler's own actions. Not least, these were the years in which Hitler's prestige and power, institutionally unchallengeable after the summer of 1934, expanded to the point where it was absolute. This point was reached when the once mighty Army Officer Corps surrendered what was left of its authority and independent power base following a scandal relating to the private lives of the two most senior military leaders in the country in early 1938. These three tendencies, erosion of collective government, emergence of clearer ideological goals, and Führer absolutism, were closely interrelated. Hitler's personal actions, particularly in the realm of foreign policy, were certainly vital to the development. But the decisive component was that unwittingly singled out in his speech by Werner Willikens. Hitler's personalized form of rule invited radical initiatives from below and offered such initiatives backing, so long as they were in line with his broadly defined goals. This promoted ferocious competition at all levels of the regime, among competing agencies and among individuals within those agencies. In the Darwinist jungle of the Third Reich, the way to power and advancement was through anticipating the Führer will and without waiting for directives, taking initiatives to promote what were presumed to be Hitler's aims and wishes. For party functionaries and ideologues, and for SS technocrats of power, working towards the Führer could have a literal meaning. But metaphorically, ordinary citizens denouncing neighbors to the Gestapo, often turning personal animosity or resentment to their advantage through political slur, businessmen happy to exploit anti-Jewish legislation to rid themselves of competitors, and the many others whose daily forms of minor cooperation with the regime took place at the cost of others, were, whatever their motives, indirectly working towards the Führer. They were, as a consequence, helping drive on an unstoppable radicalization which saw the gradual emergence in concrete shape of policy objectives embodied in the mission of the Führer. Through working towards the Führer, initiatives were taken, pressures created, legislation instigated, all in ways which fell into line with what were taken to be Hitler's aims, and without the dictator necessarily having to dictate. The result was continuing radicalization of policy in a direction which brought Hitler's own ideological imperatives more plainly into view as practicable policy options. The disintegration of the formal machinery of government and the accompanying ideological radicalization resulted then directly and inexorably from the specific form of personalized rule under Hitler. Conversely, both decisively shaped the process by which Hitler's personalized power was able to free itself from all institutional constraints and become absolute. Within this process, Hitler's growing self-confidence, swollen with each international triumph attained, as it appeared, through boldness in the face of the timidity of others, in reality achieved by pushing against a European state system which was as stable as a house of cards, intensified his already immense ego, magnified his megalomaniac tendencies, and underlined his contempt for more cautious spirits in the military leadership and Foreign Office. At the same time, every success accredited to Hitler increased his popular standing, undermined the hopes of opposition, and enhanced the readiness of any remaining doubters among the political elite to accept his outright supremacy without demur. And as the Führer cult moved towards its apogee, it became ever more clear that Hitler too had succumbed to it. The tense developments in foreign affairs culminating in the reoccupation of the Rhineland mark a crucial phase in this process. The successful outcome of the Rhineland crisis was Hitler's greatest triumph to date. By that point, he had become more than ever a convinced believer in his own myth. 1. Those close to Hitler claimed that they detected a change in him after Hindenburg's death. According to press chief Otto Dietrich, the years 1935 and 1936, with Hitler now as absolute ruler on the lookout for new deeds, were the most significant in his development from domestic reformer and social leader of the people to the later foreign policy desperado and gambler in international politics. In these years, Dietrich went on, a certain change also made itself noticeable in Hitler's personal conduct and behavior. He became increasingly unwilling to receive visitors on political matters if they had not been ordered by him to attend. Equally, he knew how to distance himself inwardly from his entourage. While, before the takeover of power, they had the possibility of putting forward their differing political opinion, he now, as head of state and person of standing, respects personne, kept strictly out of all unrequested political discussion. Hitler began to hate objections to his views and doubts on their infallibility. He wanted to speak, but not to listen. He wanted to be the hammer, not the anvil. Hitler's increasing withdrawal from domestic politics, once the period of consolidation of power had come to an end in August 1934, was, as Dietrich's remarks suggest, not simply a matter of character and choice. It also directly mirrored his position as leader, whose prestige and image could not allow him to be politically embarrassed or sullied by association with unpopular policy choices. Hitler represented, and as the regime's central integrating mechanism had to represent, the image of national unity. He could not be seen to be involved in internal day-to-day political conflict. Beyond that, his growing aloofness reflected, too, the effective transformation of domestic politics into propaganda and indoctrination. Choice and debate about options, the essence of politics, had by now been removed from the public arena, even if, of course, bitter disputes and conflicts continued behind the scenes. Politics within a coordinated Germany now amounted to what Hitler had, since the early 1920s, regarded as its sole aim, the nationalization of the masses in preparation for the great and inevitable struggle against external enemies. But this goal, the creation of a strong, united, and impregnable national community, Volksgemeinschaft, was so all-embracing, so universal in its impact, that it amounted to little more than an extremely powerful emotional incitement to formulate policy initiatives in every sphere of the regime's activity affecting all walks of life. Hitler, and the same would have been true of even a more administratively competent and efficient head of state, could not possibly have overseen, let alone directed, all such initiatives. What his form of leadership, linked to the broad directions for action which he embodied, national revival, removal of Jews, racial improvement, and restoration of Germany's power and standing in the world, did, was to unleash an unending dynamic in all avenues of policy making. As Willikens had remarked, the greatest chances of success and best opportunities for personal aggrandizement occurred where individuals could demonstrate how effectively they were working towards the Führer. But since this frenzy of activity was uncoordinated and could not be coordinated because of Hitler's need to avoid being openly drawn into disputes, it inexorably led to endemic conflict within the general understanding of following the Führer's will. And this in turn merely reinforced the impossibility of Hitler's personal involvement in resolving the conflict. Hitler was therefore, at one and the same time, the absolutely indispensable fulcrum of the entire regime, and yet largely detached from any formal machinery of government. The result, inevitably, was a high level of governmental and administrative disorder. Hitler's personal temperament, his unbureaucratic style of operating, his Darwinistic inclination to side with the stronger, and the aloofness necessitated by his role as Führer, all merged together to produce a most extraordinary phenomenon, a highly modern, advanced state without any central coordinating body and with a head of government largely disengaged from the machinery of government. However dominant Benito Mussolini and Francisco Franco, dictator of Spain after 1939, continued to run affairs through their cabinets, even if these were largely consultative bodies. Joseph Stalin retained his Politburo, despite having members of it shot on occasion. All three attempted to dominate and impose rigid control over the central machinery of government. But in Germany, cabinet meetings, which Hitler had never liked running, now lost significance. There were only 12 gatherings of ministers in 1935. By 1937, this had fallen to a mere 6 meetings. After the 5th of February 1938, the cabinet never met again. During the war, Hitler would even ban his ministers getting together occasionally over a glass of beer. In the absence of cabinet discussions, which might have determined priorities, a flood of legislation emanating independently from each ministry had to be formulated by a cumbersome and grossly inefficient process whereby drafts were circulated and recirculated among ministers until some agreement was reached. Only at that stage would Hitler, if he approved, after its contents were briefly summarized for him, signed the bill, usually scarcely bothering to read it, and turn it into law. Hans Heinrich Lammers, the head of the Reich Chancellery and sole link between the ministers and the Führer, naturally attained considerable influence over the way legislation or other business of ministers was presented to Hitler. Where Lammers decided that the Führer was too busy with other pressing matters of state, legislation that had taken months to prepare could simply be ignored or postponed, sometimes indefinitely. Alternatively, Hitler intervened, sometimes in minutiae, on the basis of some one-sided piece of information he had been fed. The result was an increasing arbitrariness as Hitler's highly personalized style of rule came into inevitable and ultimately irreconcilable conflict with bureaucracy's need for regulated norms and clearly defined procedures. Hitler's ingrained secretiveness, his preference for one-to-one meetings, which he could easily dominate, with his subordinates, and his strong favoritism among ministers and other leaders in party as well as state, were added ingredients that went to undermine formal patterns of government and administration. Access to Hitler was naturally a key element in the continuing power struggle within the regime. Ministers who had for some reason fallen out of favor could find it impossible to speak to Hitler. Agriculture Minister Walter Darré, for instance, was in the latter 1930s to attempt in vain for over 2 years to gain an audience with the Führer to discuss the country's seriously worsening agricultural problems. Though they could not hinder the access of court favorites like Goebbels and the highly ambitious young architect Albert Speer, skillful in pandering to Hitler's obsession with building plans and a rapidly rising star in the Nazi firmament, Hitler's adjutants acquired a good deal of informal power through their control of the portals of the Führer. Fritz Widemann, during the First World War Hitler's immediate superior and in the mid-1930s one of his adjutants, later recalled the extraordinary style of his arbitrary and haphazard form of personal rule. In 1935, commented Widemann, Hitler still maintained a relatively orderly routine. Mornings between about 10 a.m. and lunch at 1 or 2 p.m. were normally taken up with meetings with Lammers, State Secretary Meissner, Funk from the Propaganda Ministry, and ministers or other significant figures who had pressing business to discuss. In the afternoons, Hitler held discussions with military or foreign policy advisers, though he preferred to talk to Speer about building plans. Gradually, however, any formal routine crumbled. Hitler reverted to the type of dilettante lifestyle which, in essence, he had enjoyed as a youth in Linz and Vienna, and for which, as party leader, he had earned Gottfried Feder's reproof in the early 1920s. Later on, recalled Wiedemann, Hitler appeared as a rule only just before lunch, quickly read the press summaries provided by Reich press chief Dr. Dietrich, then went to eat. It became, therefore, ever more difficult for Lammers and Meissner to acquire decisions from Hitler which he alone as head of state could take. When Hitler was at his residence on the Obersalzberg, it was even worse. There, he invariably left his room only approaching 2 p.m. Then it was lunch. The afternoon was mainly taken up with a walk, and in the evenings, straight after the evening meal, films were shown. The walks were always downhill, with a car stationed at the bottom to ferry Hitler and his accompaniment back up again. Hitler's detestation of physical exercise and fear of embarrassment through lack of athleticism remained acute. The whole area was cordoned off during the afternoon walk to keep away the crowds of sightseers eager for a glimpse of the Führer. Instead, the tradition set in of the visitors march past, up to 2,000 people of all ages and from all parts of Germany whose devotion had persuaded them to follow the steep paths up to the Obersalzberg and often wait hours, marched at a signal from one of the adjutants in a silent column past Hitler. For Wiedemann, the adulation had quasi-religious overtones. Hitler rarely missed his evening film. The adjutants had to see to it that a fresh film was on offer each day, not always an easy task given the level of production of quality films. Hitler invariably preferred light entertainment to serious documentaries, and according to Wiedemann, probably gleaned some of his strong prejudices about the culture of other nations from such films. In the Reich Chancellery, the company was almost exclusively male, the atmosphere part way between that of a men's club and an officer's mess, with a whiff of the gangster's den thrown in. On the Obersalzberg, the mountain, as it came to be called, the presence of women, Eva Braun, and wives or lady friends of members of Hitler's entourage, helped to lighten the atmosphere, and political talk was banned as long as they were there. Hitler was courteous, even charming, in a somewhat awkwardly stiff and formal fashion to his guests, especially towards women. He was invariably correct and attentive in dealings with the secretaries, adjutants, and other attendants on his personal staff, who for the most part liked as well as respected him. He could be kind and thoughtful, as well as generous, in his choice of birthday and Christmas presents for his entourage. Even so, whether at the Reich Chancellery or on the Obersalzberg, the constrictions and tedium of living in close proximity to Hitler were considerable. Genuine informality and relaxation were difficult when he was present. Wherever he was, he dominated. In conversation, he would brook no contradiction. Guests at meals were often nervous or hesitant, lest a false word incur his displeasure. His adjutants were more concerned late at night, lest a guest unwittingly lead onto one of Hitler's favourite topics, notably the First World War or the Navy, where he would launch into yet another endless monologue which they would be forced to sit through until the early hours. Hitler's unmethodical, even casual approach to the flood of often serious matters of government brought to his attention was a guarantee of administrative disorder. He disliked reading files, recalled Wiedemann. I got decisions out of him, even on very important matters, without him ever asking me for the relevant papers. He took the view that many things sorted themselves out if they were left alone. Hitler's lethargy regarding paperwork knew one major exception. When it came to preparing his speeches, which he composed himself, he would withdraw into his room and could work deep into the night, several evenings running, occupying three secretaries, taking dictation straight into the typewriter, before carefully correcting the drafts. The public image was vital. He remained, above all, the propagandist par excellence. Even had Hitler been far more conscientious and less idiosyncratic and haphazard in his style of leadership, he would have found the highly personalized direction of the complex and varied issues of a modern state beyond him. As it was, the doors were opened wide to mismanagement and corruption on a massive scale. Hitler coupled financial incompetence and disinterest with an entirely exploitative and cavalier usage of public funds. Posts were found for old fighters. Vast amounts of money were poured into the construction of imposing representative buildings. Architects and builders were lavishly rewarded. For favoured building or artistic projects, money was no object. Leading figures in the regime could draw upon enormous salaries, enjoy tax relief, and benefit further from gifts, donations, and bribes to accommodate their extravagant tastes in palatial homes, fine trappings, works of art, and other material luxuries, including, of course, the inevitable showy limousines. Labour Front boss Robert Ley, a former Rhineland Gauleiter with a doctorate in food chemistry, a notorious womanizer who acquired the well-earned nickname of Reich Drunkard, Reichstrunkenbold, was one notable case, though he was merely part of the tip of a very large iceberg. His self-evident venality and luxury living were a blatant affront to many in the working class earning pitiful wages for back-breaking labour. But ordinary Germans knew nothing, for example, of his use of funds from the Bank of German Labour, Bank der Deutschen Arbeit, to buy back at twice the purchase price the Berlin villa acquired by the commander of Hitler's bodyguard, Sepp Dietrich, who had soon tired of his luxury home in the capital and wanted to replace it with one in Munich, nor of the bank's offer of what amounted to a handsome bribe to Hitler's adjutant Fritz Widemann. Corruption was rife at all levels of the regime. Hitler was happy to indulge the infinite craving for the material trappings of power and success of his underlings, aware that corruption on a massive scale ensured loyalty as the Third Reich developed into a modern variant of a feudal system resting on personal allegiance rewarded by private fiefdoms. He himself, by now a millionaire on the proceeds of sales of Mein Kampf, led his publicly acclaimed Spartan lifestyle, as regards his food and clothing, in a context of untold luxury. Alongside his magnificent apartments, his official one in Berlin and his private one in Munich, the initial, somewhat modest, Alpine residence, Haus Wachenfeld on the Obersalzberg, was now converted at vast expense into the grandiose Berghof, suitable for state visits of foreign dignitaries. His restless energy demanded that he and his sizable entourage were almost constantly on the move within Germany. For that, a special train with 11 coaches containing sleeping compartments, a fleet of limousines and 3 aeroplanes stood at his disposal. Even more serious than the way corrupt party despots profited from the bonanza of a seemingly unlimited free-for-all with public funds was the corruption of the political system itself. In the increasing absence of any formal procedures for arriving at political decisions, favoured party bosses with access to Hitler were often able, over lunch or at coffee, to put forward some initiative and manipulate a comment of approval to their own advantage. Hitler's impulsive verbal agreement to suggestions from subordinate leaders could prove embarrassing. When, in October 1934, Robert Ley obtained Hitler's signature on a decree which would have strengthened the hand of the Labour Front at the expense of employers and the state authorities, the trustees of Labour, it led to difficulties. Neither the Ministry of Labour nor the Ministry of Economics had been properly consulted. The party's head, Rudolf Hess, personally at loggerheads with Ley, who, in addition to being boss of the Labour Front, had also been placed by Hitler in charge of the party's organisational matters, bringing him directly and repeatedly into conflict with Hess, also strongly protested. Unable to antagonise economic supremo Schacht and the industrial leadership, Hitler had to comply with the pressure. To preserve his prestige, the decree was not revoked, but simply ignored, and fell into desuetude, however much Ley tried to have recourse to it. A few months later, in early 1935, the reverse happened when Hitler bowed to party pressure, having initially agreed to a proposal from a Reich government minister. Labour Minister Zelter had won Hitler's support for his plans to replace the regionally weighted wage structure for building workers by a unified structure across the Reich. This led to loud protests from the Gauleiter, the party's regional chieftains. Gauleiter Kaufmann of Hamburg was especially vociferous about the impact of wage reductions in some areas on worker morale. Hitler backed down. Again, for prestige purposes, the earlier decision could not simply be rescinded as a mistake. Instead, Hitler ordered further deliberations over an indefinite period before the wage revision should be implemented. This meant the matter was shelved and forgotten. In the two examples just cited, specific policy initiatives which ran foul of the vested interests of powerful groups in the regime had to be jettisoned. Ley and Zelter found on these occasions that they ultimately turned out not to be working towards the Führer. However, Hitler's sparse involvement in initiating domestic policy during the mid and later 1930s and the disintegration of any centralized body for policy formulation meant that there was wide scope for those able to exert pressure for action in areas broadly echoing the aims of nationalization of the masses and exclusion of those deemed not to belong to the national community. The pressure came above all from two sources: the party, both its central office and its provincial bosses, the Gauleiter, and the elite organization, the SS, now merging into the police to become an ideologically driven security force of immense power. Using Hitler's professed and unlimited goals of national rebirth and strength through racial purity to legitimate their demands and actions, they ensured that the dynamic unleashed by the takeover of power would not subside. Once power had been attained in 1933, the NSDAP, its numbers now rapidly swelling through the intake of hundreds of thousands of opportunists, became in essence a loosely coordinated vehicle of propaganda and social control. Hitler had, in any case, in destroying the organizational structure built up by Gregor Strasser, already determined in December 1932 that mobilization behind the National Socialist idea, embodied in his own person, was the party's task. After becoming chancellor, he had taken little interest in the party as an institution. The weak and ineffectual but devotedly loyal Rudolf Hess was in April made Hitler's deputy in charge of the party. Since Robert Ley, as we have noted, was left running the party's organizational matters, Hess's authority was, from the outset, far from complete. Nor was Hess in a strong position in his dealings with the Gauleiter, most of whom could rely on their long-standing personal bonds with Hitler to uphold their power base in the provinces. Neither a genuine hierarchical structure of command at the top of the party, nor a collective body for determining party policy, was ever instituted. The Reich leadership of the party remained a group of individuals who never met as a type of Politburo. Gauleiter conferences only took place at Hitler's own behest to hear a speech from the Führer, not to discuss policy, while a party senate was never called into existence. The party acquired, therefore, neither a coherent structure nor a systematic policy which it could enforce upon the state administration. Its essential failure, that of a Führer party tied to emotively powerful but loosely defined general aims embodied in the person of the Führer and held together by the Führer cult, ruled out both. Even so, once Hess was given in 1934 what amounted to veto rights over draft legislation by government ministers, and the following year over the appointment of higher civil servants, the party had indeed made significant inroads into the purely governmental arena. The possibilities of intervention, however unsystematic, did now increase the party's influence, above all in what it saw as crucial ideological spheres. Race policy and the church struggle were among the most important of these. In both areas, the party had no difficulty in mobilizing its activists, whose radicalism in turn forced the government into legislative action. In fact, the party leadership often found itself compelled to respond to pressures from below, stirred up by Gauleiter playing their own game, or emanating sometimes from radical activists at local level. Whatever the derivation, in this way the continuum of radicalization in issues associated with the Führer's aims was sustained. By the mid-1930s, Hitler paid little attention to the workings of the party. His personal participation in the life of the party was limited from now on, in essence, to his appearance at the major representative occasions in Munich, Nuremberg, etc., and to the speeches which he regularly held in November and February before his old guard, commented Otto Dietrich. The dualism of party and state was never resolved, and was not resolvable. Hitler himself welcomed the overlaps in competence and lack of clarity. sensitive as always to any organizational framework which might have constrained his own power, he undermined all attempts at Reich reform by Frick, aimed at producing a more rational, authoritarian state structure. Hitler's approach to the state, as to all power relations, was purely exploitative and opportunistic. It was for him, as he had expressly stated in Mein Kampf, purely a means to an end, the vague notion of upholding and advancing a community of physically and mentally similar beings, the sustaining of those racial basic elements which, as bestowers of culture, create the beauty and dignity of a higher type of human being. It followed that he gave no consideration to forms and structures, only to effect. His crude notion was that if a specific sphere of policy could not be best served by a government ministry, weighed down by bureaucracy, then another organization, run as unbureaucratically as possible, should manage it. The new bodies were usually set up as directly responsible to Hitler himself, and straddled party and state without belonging to either. The organization taught the Hitler Youth, and from 1936 the four-year plan, were such institutions. In reality, of course, this process merely erected new, competing, sometimes overlapping bureaucracies, and led to unending demarcation disputes. These did not trouble Hitler, but their effect was at one and the same time to undermine still further any coherence of government and administration, and to promote the growing autonomy within the regime of Hitler's own position as Führer. The most important and ideologically radical new plenipotentiary institution directly dependent on Hitler was the combined SS police apparatus, which had fully emerged by mid-1936. Already before the Röhm Putsch, Himmler had extended his initial power base in Bavaria to gain control over the police in one state after another, culminating in his nomination in April 1934 as Inspector of the Gestapo, accompanied by Reinhard Heydrich as head of the office of the Prussian secret state police, Gestapo. After the SS had played such a key part in breaking the power of the SA leadership at the end of June, Himmler had been able to push home his advantage until Göring conceded full control over the security police in the largest of the states. Attempts by Reich Minister of the Interior Frick and Justice Minister Gertner to curb autonomous police power, expanding through the unrestricted use of protective custody, Schutzhaft, and control of the growing domain of the concentration camps, also ended in predictable failure. Where legal restrictions on the power of the police were mooted, Himmler could invariably reckon with Hitler's backing. When, in 1935, Gertner complained about the number of deaths occurring in concentration camps and demanded the presence of lawyers in cases of protective custody, Himmler went to Hitler and won his support for a ban on consultation of lawyers and a block on any special measures owing to the conscientious direction of the camps. Frick had no greater success with his protests at abuses of protective custody. Indeed, Himmler gained Hitler's authorization to expand the concentration camp system at a time, in summer 1935, when with 3,500 internees, it was smaller than at any other period throughout the Third Reich and appeared to have exhausted its prime purpose. This was followed in October 1935 by Hitler's backing for the Gestapo as the decisive agent in the struggle against the internal enemies of the nation. Himmler's concessions in the Prussian Gestapo law of the 10th of February 1936 were purely nominal. While one clause of the law subordinated the Gestapo to the Ministry of the Interior, another emphasized that it was ultimately responsible to the Gestapo. There was no doubt which would prevail in case of conflict. The next step was not long in coming. On the 17th of June, Hitler's decree created a unified Reich police under Himmler's command. The most powerful agency of repression thus merged with the most dynamic ideological force in the Nazi movement. Himmler's subordination to Frick, through the office he had just taken up as chief of the German police, existed only on paper. As head of the SS, Himmler was personally subordinate only to Hitler himself. With the politicization of conventional criminal actions, through the blending of the criminal and political police in the newly formed security police a week later, the ideological powerhouse of the Third Reich, an executive organ of the Führer will, had essentially taken shape. The instrument had been forged, which saw the realization of the Führer's Weltanschauung as its central aim. Himmler saw the prime task of the merged police and SS as the internal defense of the people in one of the great struggles of human history against the universally destructive force of Bolshevism. For Werner Best, Heydrich's deputy, the police were a fighting formation existing to root out all symptoms of disease and germs of destruction that threatened the political health of the nation. No directions from Hitler were needed to encourage a police force starting from such premises to expand the target groups of those dubbed enemies of the state or harmful to the people. The list could be extended almost at will. Alongside the prime racial victims, the Jews, and the foremost ideological and political enemies, communists and socialists, or the Freemasons, a secret society held in deep suspicion for its alleged international power network and links with Jews engaged in world conspiracy. Assiduous police careerists and SS ideologues blended their efforts to find new internal enemies to combat. Most were weak, unpopular and marginalized social groups such as gypsies, homosexuals, beggars, antisocials, work-shy, and habitual criminals. In addition, the drive to eliminate any institutional space turned persecution not only against those unprepared to yield to the total claim of the Nazi state, Jehovah's Witnesses, or politically active representatives of the main Christian denominations, but also against small Christian sects which bent over backwards to accommodate National Socialism, such as the Mormons, or the Seventh-day Adventists. Intensification of radicalism was built into the nature of such a police force, which combined ruthlessness and efficiency of persecution with ideological purpose and dynamism. Directions and dictates from Hitler were not needed. The SS and police had individuals and departments more than capable of ensuring that the discrimination kept spiraling. The rise of Adolf Eichmann, from an insignificant figure collecting information on Zionism, but located in what would rapidly emerge as a key department, the SD's Jewish desk in Berlin, to manager of the Final Solution, showed how initiative and readiness to grasp opportunities not only brought rewards in power and aggrandizement to the individual concerned, but also pushed on the process of radicalization precisely in those areas most closely connected with Hitler's own ideological fixations. In the mid-1930s, this process was still in its early stages, but pressures for action from the party in ideological concerns regarded as central to National Socialism and the instrumentalization of those concerns through the expanding repressive apparatus of the police meant that there was no sagging ideological momentum once power had been consolidated, as was the case in Mussolini's Italy or Franco's Spain. And as initiatives formulated at different levels and by different agencies of the regime attempted to accommodate the ideological drive, the idea of National Socialism located in the person of the Führer thus gradually became translated from utopian vision into realizable policy objectives. 2. The beginnings of this process were also visible in Germany's foreign relations. Nothing did more to bolster Hitler's self-confidence than his successful coups in Europe's diplomatic revolution. Most spectacular were the reintroduction of conscription in March 1935 and the reoccupation of the Rhineland almost exactly a year later. The results abroad were to destroy the remnants of the post-war diplomatic settlement, upturn the European order, seal the fatal division and weakening of the Western powers, and drastically to loosen the constraints on the build-up of German military might. At home, Hitler's immense popularity and acclaim attained untouched levels. The triumphs of boldness over caution, as it seemed, strengthened his hand over the more restrained and circumspect among the military and foreign policy advisers. As Otto Dietrich detected, they also enhanced Hitler's belief in his own infallibility. Hitler's own greatest contribution to events with such momentous consequences lay in his gambling instinct, his use of bluff, and his sharp antennae for the weak spots of his opponents. He took the key decisions. He alone determined the timing. But little else was Hitler's own work. The broad aims of rearmament and revision of Versailles, though each notion hid a variety of interpretations, united policymakers and power groups, whatever the differences in emphasis, in the military and the Foreign Office. Apart from the drama surrounding Germany's withdrawal from the League of Nations in October 1933, the first 2 years of Hitler's chancellorship had been largely dominated by internal affairs. Given German defensive weakness on both eastern and western borders and diplomatic isolation, there was no alternative to wariness in foreign affairs in these early years. The dangers of military intervention by either the Poles or the French were taken seriously. As Bernard von Bülow, State Secretary in the Foreign Office, put it in his memorandum of the 13th of March 1933, Germany's dangerous weakness compelled a policy of avoiding foreign policy conflicts for as long as possible until we are strong again. Rearmament in secret had to go along with public readiness to appear conciliatory. Repeated emphasis on the unfair treatment of Germany in the post-war settlement would continue to probe the obvious divisions between the French and British, arising from their differing views on the harshness of Versailles, their divergent foreign policy interests, more obviously global in Britain's case, and the corresponding variation on the likely dangers of a resurgent Germany and the ways of containing rearmament and any revisionist claims. Meanwhile, once Germany's diplomatic isolation was sealed by its withdrawal from the League of Nations, any opportunity of bilateral agreements in Eastern Europe, which would prevent German ambitions being contained by the multilateral pacts striven for by the French, was to be seized. The first indicator of such a move was the non-aggression pact with Poland. Germany's departure from the League of Nations had intensified the mutual interest in an improved relationship. The pact benefited Germany in undermining French influence in Eastern Europe, thereby removing the possibility of any combined Franco-Polish military action against Germany. For the Poles, it provided at least the temporary security felt necessary in the light of diminished protection afforded through the League of Nations, weakened by the German withdrawal. The first moves had come from the Poles. Bülow had recorded traditional Foreign Office animosity towards Poland when, in his March tour d'horizon of foreign policy options, he had remarked that an understanding with the Poles was neither possible nor desired. Piłsudski's government had, however, put out feelers towards a better relationship the following month. It was, as Hitler realized, also in Germany's interests, whatever the official Foreign Office view, to lessen tension on its eastern borders. Diplomatic activity over the summer of 1933 succeeded in improving relations between Danzig, where National Socialists now dominated the government, and Poland. Danzig had been a point of friction between Germany and Poland since the post-war peace settlement. Offering an outlet to the sea demanded by the new Polish state, and surrounded by territory taken from Germany and handed to Poland, Danzig's overwhelming German population had meant that the Versailles principles of territorial integrity and national self-determination could not be reconciled. The result was the compromise to make Danzig a free city, autonomous under League of Nations supervision. The Poles had access to the sea, but no harbour of their own. The Germans had not ceded Danzig to Poland, but had not retained it for the Reich. No one was happy, least of all the people of Danzig. It was a solution unlikely to stand the test of time. But for the moment, despite the almost inevitable upsurge of support in Danzig for a stridently nationalist government in the Reich, relations were improving between the Free City and the Polish government, prompted by the need for détente felt both in Berlin and in Warsaw. Steps were also taken towards ending the long-standing trade war between Germany and Poland. Hitler himself pressed for the trade agreement, which was being painstakingly worked out between the two countries, to be extended to a non-aggression treaty. From his point of view, treaties were matters of expediency. They were to be held to as long as they served their purpose. He was prepared to appear generous in his dealings with the Poles. There was a new urgency in negotiations. Neurath and the Foreign Office, initially set for a different course, swiftly trimmed their sails to the new wind. As if by orders from the top, a change of front toward us is taking place all along the line. In Hitlerite spheres they talk about the new Polish-German friendship, noted Józef Lipski, Polish minister to Berlin, on the 3rd of December 1933. In conditions of great secrecy, a 10-year non-aggression treaty was prepared and sprung on an astonished Europe on the 26th of January 1934. This early shift in German foreign policy plainly bore Hitler's imprint. No parliamentary minister between 1920 and 1933 could have gone so far, noted Ernst von Weizsäcker, at that time German ambassador in Bern. The rapprochement with Poland meant, inevitably, a new course towards the Soviet Union. Initially, little or nothing had altered the modus vivendi based on mutual advantage, which, despite deteriorating relations during the last years of the Weimar Republic, and despite ideological antipathy, had existed since the treaties of Rapallo in 1922 and Berlin in 1926. Soviet worries about the Hitler regime were soothed by the German ambassador Herbert von Dirksen, whose own expressed anxieties met with the reassurance of State Secretary Bülow. The National Socialists, faced with responsibility, are naturally different people and follow a policy other than that which they have previously proclaimed. That's always been so, and is the same with all parties, he complacently added. From summer onwards, however, contrary to the wishes of the Foreign Office, and despite mounting concern of its Soviet equivalent, though in line with the clamour of the Nazi movement, diplomatic relations worsened significantly. In autumn 1933, Hitler himself ruled out any repair of relations. During 1934, despite the efforts of the German ambassador Rudolf Nadolny, who had replaced Dirksen in autumn the previous year, and Soviet overtures for better relations, the deterioration continued. Hitler himself blocked any improvement, leading to Nadolny's resignation. The inevitable consequence was to push the Soviet Union closer to France, thus enlarging the spectre of encirclement on which Nazi propaganda so readily played. In early 1935, the Soviet Union was still little more than a side issue in German foreign policy. Relations with the Western powers were the chief concern. The divisions, weakness, and need to carry domestic opinion of the Western democracies would soon play into Hitler's hands, but before taking any steps in foreign policy, or in addressing the increasingly pressing issue of the expansion of the armed forces, it was becoming imperative for Hitler to calm the internal tensions which had developed between the army and the Nazi movement, overshadowing the last months of 1934 and threatening his relations with the military leadership. Underlying the tension were the promises Hitler had made to the SS at the time of the Röhm affair for the military arming of SS units, the origins of the later Waffen-SS, thus immediately breaking the promise he had made to the army that it alone would be the bearer of arms in the Reich. The SS were then at the forefront of a wave of scarcely veiled attacks on the military leadership, also involving the SA and other sections of the movement, which punctuated the autumn of 1934, doing little for the confidence of army leaders in Hitler or his party. Domestic unrest, continued criticism of local party leaders in the wake of intense disappointment at the failure to undertake a more drastic purge of the party following the murder of the SA leaders, and not least, the damaging effects of the church struggle on popular morale, also contributed. The military leadership plainly felt its position under threat by what it saw as the total claim of the Nazi movement. For their part, Nazi activists were resentful of the power of what they took to be a bastion of reaction with protected status. Hitler could afford, finally, to stand back no longer. He was compelled to intervene. At extraordinarily short notice, only one day, he summoned, for the 3rd of January 1935, a uniquely entitled meeting of the German leadership, Deutsche Führerschaft, in Berlin's State Opera House. Rudolf Hess took the chair. The party Reichsleiter and Gauleiter were present, so were the top leaders of the armed forces. Hitler spoke for 1.5 hours, with the overriding object of restoring the faith of the military in the National Socialist leadership. He stressed his will to make Germany a great power again, its defences secured through a strong Wehrmacht. This could only be attained through total unity. He referred again to the two pillars of the Wehrmacht and the army on which the National Socialist state rested. He demanded restoration of the mutual trust between the two. He assured the army that he was on their side. He would disbelieve any comments and tear up any reports from those in the party claiming that army leaders were criticizing or opposing him, "for my faith in the Wehrmacht is unshakable," he declared. Weeping, he beseeched party leaders to see that only absolute loyalty and devotion to him in a united community would enable him to rebuild Germany. As in the Strasse crisis of 1932, the high point of the theatricals was his threat to commit suicide if this unity were not forthcoming. The contrived drama of the speech did the trick. The applause was tumultuous. The army leaders were won over, impressed by what they saw as Hitler's moving declaration of loyalty to the armed forces. Goering ended the meeting, representing the unity of party, state, and military leadership in his own person, with a vote of thanks to Hitler. Once more, Hitler had succeeded in presenting himself as the indispensable unifier, reconciling through his mission the conflicting interests of the differing sections of the power cartel. In the meantime, a rich propaganda gift was about to fall into Hitler's lap with the return of the Tsar territory to Germany through the plebiscite of the 13th of January 1935. The Versailles Treaty had removed the Tsar land from Germany, placing it under League of Nations control for 15 years and affording France the right to its resources. After 15 years, it was foreseen that the Tsar inhabitants, roughly 500,000 voters, should decide whether they would prefer to return to Germany, become part of France, or retain the status quo. It was always likely that the majority of the largely German-speaking population, where resentment at the treatment meted out in 1919 still smouldered fiercely, would want to return to Germany. A good deal of work by the German government prepared the ground, and as the plebiscite day approached, Goebbels unleashed a massive barrage of propaganda directed at the Tsar inhabitants and raising consciousness of the issue at home. Berlin could feel confident that the plebiscite would result in a vote to return the Tsar to Germany. According to the French ambassador, André-François Poncet, however, Hitler would not have been surprised if the French had attempted to forestall a German triumph by taking possession of the territory or by adjourning the date of the plebiscite. Moreover, the Tsar territory was overwhelmingly Catholic, with a large industrial working-class segment of the population. The two social groups which had proved least enthusiastic about Nazism within Germany itself. In the light of the ferocious repression of the left and the threatening, if still largely sporadic, persecution of the Catholic Church that had followed the Nazi takeover in Germany, opponents of the Hitler regime in the Tsar could still harbour illusions of a substantial anti-Nazi vote. But the Catholic authorities put their weight behind a return to Germany, and many Tsar Catholics already looked to Hitler as the leader who would rescue them from Bolshevism. On the left, the massive erosion of party loyalties had set in long before the plebiscite. For all their propaganda efforts, the message of the dwindling number of social democrat and communist functionaries fell largely on stony ground. Nazi propaganda had little difficulty in trumpeting the alternative to a return to Germany: continued massive unemployment, economic exploitation by France, and lack of any political voice. Some concerted intimidation, as in the Reich itself during the time of struggle, did the rest. For the vast majority, workers and Catholics, middle class and better off alike, there seemed no choice to speak of. The future lay with Hitler's Germany. Nationalist emotion and material self-interest went hand in hand. When the votes were counted, just under 91% of the Tsar's electorate had freely chosen dictatorship. At least two-thirds of the former supporters of both left-wing parties had supported the return to Germany. Any lingering doubts about whether Hitler had the genuine backing of the German people were dispelled. Hitler milked his triumph for all that it was worth. At the same time, he was careful to make dove-like noises for public consumption. "Following the completion of your return," he told the Tsar people, "the German Reich had no further territorial demands to make of France." And, in an interview with the Daily Mail journalist Ward Price, 4 days after the plebiscite, he intoned, "Germany will of its own accord, von sich aus, never break the peace." On the 1st of March, the day of the formal incorporation of the Tsar territory in the Reich, Hitler spoke in Saarbrücken. He was supremely happy, überglücklich. he declared, to be able to take part in this day of happiness for the entire nation and for the whole of Europe. He hoped that as a consequence of the settlement of the Saar issue, relations between Germany and France had improved once and for all. Just as we want peace, so we must hope that our great neighbouring people is also willing and ready to seek this peace with us. Hitler's true thoughts were different.